Welcome back to A Case of the Sunday Scaries. I'm Elise, and this is part two of the deep dive into the terrifying timeline of Ted Bundy's crimes. But before we get started, you're probably thinking, Elise, part two was supposed to come out last week. Why'd you leave us hanging? Well, it's been an interesting couple of weeks. First of all, I got hacked. It's kind of ironic considering I do a true crime podcast, but it started with my Instagram account, and suddenly, early in the morning, there was some, let's just say, inappropriate posts and messages going out. Now, I'm not knocking the OnlyFans hustle, but I do not have an OnlyFans page. And if you follow me on Instagram, at EliseMichelle_MUA, you probably got quite a shock seeing the type of content on my page. And as for the hackers, well, they wanted $800 for me to give it back to them. Thankfully, an absolute angel helped me regain control of it, but then the hackers got kind of pissed off, and they decided to go for the big guns, which was my business Meta accounts and YouTube. And before you say, Elise, two-factor authentication, I know. Sometimes I'm just too lazy to enter code every time I sign into my social media. But my lesson is learned. I've got Duo, the app, so do your worst, hackers. Well, actually don't, because that was not very fun. But then, to top it all off, I had a little accident and broke one of my back molars right down to the gum line. Long story short, the open wound got infected. So not only did I look like this, like a puffer fish, but I was in top five pain that I've ever been in, I think. I have a pretty high tolerance, but tooth pain and an infection, it was debilitating. So thankfully, I'm on the mend now, and in a few weeks, I'll have a shiny new crown on my tooth, and no one will be the wiser. But you kind of need a working mouth to host a podcast. Who knew? So I appreciate all your patience while I healed and regained access to all my accounts. Now, with all that said, let's get back into the story of Ted Bundy.
Dear friends and family, years ago when I was first arrested, was that they just, there was no clue. They looked at me and they looked at the all-American boy. And people need to recognize those of us who have been so much influenced by violence in the media in particular, are not some kinds of inherent monsters. We are your sons and we are your husbands.
When we left off, we were diving into Ted Bundy's early life and how he didn't really show the usual red flags of a future serial killer. We also covered his first confirmed victims and the heartbreaking murder of Linda Healy. Today, I'm going to go a little bit deeper into more of his heinous crimes, how he managed to slip through the cracks for so long, and the eventual downfall of America's most notorious serial killers. I cannot emphasize enough just how twisted Ted Bundy really was. As we continue with this case today and share his victim stories, it's going to get pretty intense. I'll be discussing some very disturbing details about his crimes. So grab your coffee or tea, because I definitely wouldn't recommend eating during this episode. And let's dive back into the chilling story of Ted Bundy. After Ted murdered Linda, it set off a chain of events. For the first half of 1974, approximately one girl per month went missing in Washington state. In March, 18-year-old Donna Gail Manson, a college student, was on her way to a concert when she just disappeared. Bundy would later confess to killing her, but sadly, her body was never found. Ted had a reason for this, though. He said that he had decapitated her and burned her skull in his girlfriend's fireplace, quote, down to the last ash in a fit of paranoia and cleanliness. But he's a lying piece of shit, because I got to Googling, as I do, and it is impossible to burn a human adult body down to ash in a fireplace. Because sure, flesh is going to burn, but turning bone into ash requires temperatures of 1400 to 1800 degrees Fahrenheit. The average household fireplace only burns at about 1,000 degrees. So nice try on that one, Ted. You're going to find out that Ted is a liar. He lies constantly, whether it's to make his crimes seem a little bit less heinous than they actually were. So just take everything he says with a huge grain of salt. 18-year-old Susan Raincourt, also from Alaska, She was a biology major and part of the pre-med program until she disappeared from the Central Washington State College campus on April 17, 1974. When her parents were notified about her missing, they instantly knew their responsible daughter would not have just run off. Her father, Dale, said, quote, "If it were one of my other children, I'd probably just say, stand by, they'll be back in 2 or 3 days. But not Susan. She was always very careful." Her dad, Dale, also shared a comment that, in light of recent events, gave me a bit of a chuckle. Susan had extensive dental work done and was a bit obsessive about her oral hygiene. When her dad saw that her dental floss was still in her dorm room, he knew that Susan hadn't planned to leave for any extended period of time. Dentists everywhere are probably applauding, but let's all aim to be a bit more like Susan when it comes to oral hygiene, because we all hear when we talk about these crimes, there's that one thing, like they were never late to work. They would have gone and picked up their kids. But for the dental floss to be what made everyone, especially the people closest to her, know, like, nope, that is the one item she would never leave her house without. It's pretty impressive dental hygiene, let's just say it. There was an extensive search for her, covering 62 square miles. And in a decision that baffles me, they had local Boy Scouts help in the search. And I sincerely hope that these were Eagle Scouts or whatever rank it is when you become a teenager, because I'm picturing like little 8-year-old boys in their Boy Scout uniforms trekking through the forest looking for what we would imagine would be a dead body at this point. What were they thinking? Clearly, in the 1970s, they did not have a good grasp on PTSD, because who's footing the therapy bill for a tiny little Boy Scout if he's the one who finds the corpse? Who thought that that was a good idea? Could you even imagine being that kid? 1 minute you're learning how to tie knots and earn badges, and the next you're on a search and recovery mission. It's mind-blowing that they thought that was a good idea. Susan was known for being sensible and, quote, wholesome. But from what I've gathered, she was really, really kind-hearted. She wanted to be a doctor, she worked at a nursing home, and she tutored other students. Susan literally lived a life of service to others. But tragically, Ted Bundy was perfecting what would become part of his sinister MO. He preyed on the generosity and kindness of women like Suzanne by pretending to be injured and asking for help. He needed something carried to his car. And once they got close enough, he'd render them unconscious and shove them into the back of his VW bug, never to be seen again. During the investigation into Susan's disappearance, 2 Central Washington students came forward with a crucial lead. They'd seen a man that they didn't recognize lurking around campus. A few days before Susan vanished, one of those eyewitnesses, a 21-year-old student named Catherine, was leaving the library when a man in an arm sling approached her. He was struggling with a pile of books, and Catherine, being the kind soul she was, offered to help him get his belongings to his car. Now, ladies, I've said it before, and I will never stop saying it. Women's intuition is real, and thank God Catherine listened to hers. As she helped him, she noticed his car was parked far away from the library in a really dark, quiet area. Just as they reached the vehicle, the man dropped his keys by the passenger door of his VW bug, and asked her to pick them up for him. Catherine got the heebie-jeebies. She trusted her gut, grabbed his keys without turning her back to him, and quickly ran off. Because she never turned her back to Ted, he didn't get the chance to attack her from behind, which was his usual method to ensure his victims would never know what was coming and would never have time to scream. Something to note here, there was no passenger seat in Bundy's VW bug. He had removed it completely. Obviously, this was so he could easily get girls into the back seat because his bug only had one door, so trying to pull the front passenger seat forward and get an unconscious body into the back would be extremely difficult and time-consuming. Someone could see him. But as I was researching this case, you realize just how much thought Ted Bundy put into his crimes, not only in removing the front seat, but everyone said that he wore his cast or his arm sling on his left arm, which at first I thought was some sort of mistake. Eyewitness testimonies are known for not being very reliable. And I thought maybe they just got it wrong, because Ted Bundy was left-handed. Why would he basically make his whole dominant arm unusable? But then it clicked. Unless he was ambidextrous, having the sling on his right arm would, one, make it more believable when he's struggling to carry things with his less dominant arm, but more so, you would need your right arm because he needs to get in the car, and if your victim wakes up or you need to move something, you need your right arm free to control the situation. Does that make sense? Like, you've put somebody in the backseat of your car. If your right arm is in a sling or a cast and that person becomes awake or you need to move something, you need that arm to be able to reach into the back seat. And I don't say this to be like, oh, that Ted, he's so smart. He just thought of everything. Absolutely not. I just find it horrifying, but also a little fascinating how much malice aforethought that this proves. Every decision that this man made, big or small, like removing the passenger car seat, putting a sling or cast on his left arm as opposed to his right arm, every choice that this man makes was meticulously planned to ensure that he would cause maximum destruction. 2 days after the search for Susan was called off on May 6th, Roberta Kathleen Parks, also known as Kathy, a 20-year-old student at Oregon State University, completely disappeared. Her story to me is particularly sad because Kathy had been going through a really rough patch emotionally. She had a difficult, strained relationship with her father, and on the night of May 6th, she'd gotten a call with the devastating news that he had suffered a heart attack. Understandably, this news would be very upsetting to anyone, but Kathy reportedly sometimes used alcohol to cope with depressive episodes, so she might have had a bit to drink that evening, possibly making her more open to talking about her problems, even with a stranger. Ted Bundy later would say that he approached her in the cafeteria, and like the predator he is, it's possible that he noticed that Kathy was potentially an easier target that evening. What could I possibly mean by that? Now, first, let me be clear. Nothing that happened to Kathy was her fault at all. It is always the perpetrator's fault. But Ted Bundy is notoriously quoted as saying, "I have known people who just radiate vulnerability. Their facial expressions say, 'I'm afraid of you.' These people invite abuse by expecting to be hurt. Do they subtly encourage it?" And the answer to that, Ted, since you asked, no, they are not inviting you to hurt them. I wanted to dive into this a bit more because his quote really bothered me. And I think the reason it really bothered me is someone has said something in my past quite similar to this, but directed towards me. Like they just could sense that I had been through something and that like I was... I don't even know what it was meant, and it's a little nerve-wracking. But how did Ted Bundy know who would be the most vulnerable? I got back on the Google machine, as I do, and I found a really interesting study called Psychopathy and Victim Selection, the Use of Gait as a Cue to Vulnerability. In this study, they showed violent offenders very short clips of people walking and asked them to rate their vulnerability based solely on nonverbal cues. Psychopaths, particularly, were eerily accurate in distinguishing which people in the clips had a prior but undisclosed history of abuse, often citing their gait, which is how they walk, as their reason for picking them out as vulnerable and choosing them as targets. Psychopaths are incredibly manipulative, and they often are particularly skilled in exploiting the weaknesses of others. And this requires that they become very good at recognizing cues of vulnerability in potential victims. So while Ted's twisted perception and his horrible quote try to justify his actions, it really only highlights the depths of how manipulative and predatory he really was. In the first episode, we talked about nature versus nurture and killers. And I wonder where this animalistic ability to pick out what they perceive as weak or vulnerable, where does it lie? Is this something that Ted developed as part of his own twisted game, allowing him to pick out, based on nonverbal cues, people that were more likely to show kindness to a stranger? Psychopaths are known to be exceptional at exploiting weaknesses in others, but where the heck does that even come from? Is it nature or is it nurture? Is this ability to pinpoint vulnerability something that's embedded deep in like the subconscious of the mind of a psychopath from birth? Or is this skill developed through a lifetime of predatory behavior? I don't know, but I want to hear what you guys think. Whenever I research this kind of material into psychopathy, they always reference, like, don't worry, it's only 1% of people that even have this diagnosis. And that kind of weirdly comforts me until you do the math, because 1% sounds like a very small number, right? There's about 8 billion people on this planet. And 1% of 8 billion people means that there's approximately 80 million potential psychopaths just wandering the earth. Are all of them going to become someone like Ted Bundy? Of course not. But, ugh, I hate math, because 1% sounds a lot better than 80 million.
A lot of trouble. I mean, genuine trouble. Big mistake.
There are an infinite number of ways to explain how a man can come to the point where he destroys human life.
I used to see a good-looking girl, and one minute I'd be thinking how nice it'd be to go out with her. And then the next instant, I was thinking how nice her head would look on a stick.
But back to this study. It's pretty terrifying, right? That there's people out there that can look at someone, how they walk, not even speak a word to them, and kind of do this read on them to know that they might be easier to manipulate and hurt. Ugh, I hate the thought of that. And remember, Kathy had gotten horrible news that evening. Her dad had had a heart attack. So of course she's upset, and perhaps she was a little more expressive than she would be if she was actually using alcohol that evening. And instead of most of us who are sensitive to the vibes of those around us and want to help someone out, she very tragically was approached by a man who would only want to prey on her vulnerability. That man was Ted Bundy. Ted would later confess that after luring Kathy to his car, he tied her up and gagged her before driving her back to Washington State, which is a little bit of a diversion from his MO of hitting a woman over the head before putting her into his vehicle. But Ted's a liar. We know that already. So who knows what actually happened? Unfortunately, he did admit to assaulting her twice during the 200-plus mile drive back to Washington before he ended her life savagely at Taylor Mountain. On June 1st, Brenda Carroll Ball, who was just 22, was having a night out at the Flame Tavern near the Seattle airport. But when she left that evening, she was never seen again. Eyewitnesses at the bar told police that they had seen Brenda talking to a man who had his arm in a sling in the parking lot that evening. Ted Bundy, known for his lies and manipulation, claimed that they went back to his house where they had consensual sex before he strangled her. And I just want to say, bullshit, Ted. Bullshit. Because, first of all, Ted Bundy had some depraved sexual desires that we will get into later that certainly did not include his victims being willing participants. And second, he couldn't or wouldn't explain the injuries that were found on Brenda's skull when her remains were recovered. I think it's much more likely that he hit Brenda over the head and kept her at his house unconscious or perhaps post-mortem until he dumped her body. Just 10 days later, 18-year-old University of Washington student Georgianne Hawkins went to a campus party with her sorority sister. She couldn't stay long because she was worried about her Spanish final, but she told her friend she was going to stop by the Beta Delta Pi house. I wasn't part of Greek life, so excuse me if I mispronounced that. But she was going to stop by to tell her boyfriend goodnight and get his Spanish notes. She was only at the fraternity house for a short time and left around a half an hour later, around 1 a.m. roughly. There was a brightly lit alley between his fraternity and her sorority, and it was only about 90 feet from his home to her front door, six houses away. But sadly, Georgianne never made it back. She was reported missing early the next morning. Georgianne sounded like an amazing young woman. Her mother lovingly called her the Pied Piper because she had quite a following, but wasn't the type to stick to one group or clique. She had friends among everyone, older and younger. She was a very self-confident girl, neither vain nor arrogant, which is why the kids liked to be around her. Georgianne seemed to carry that temperament throughout her short life. She was a straight-A student and had just accepted a summer job in her hometown to help pay for her second year at college, where she planned to major in broadcast journalism. That job would have started just a week after she went missing. Ted Bundy would later say that he approached Georgianne, hobbling along with crutches this time, and asked her to help carry his briefcase to his car. She believed him. I mean, Ted kind of looked unassuming, and she agreed to help. But when she bent over to put the briefcase in the back of his car, as per usual, he hit her over the head with a crowbar. Ted said something about this particular victim that pissed me off so much. He said that when Georgianne regained consciousness during their car ride, quote, "It's funny. It's not funny, but it's odd, the things people will say under those circumstances. She thought, well, she said she thought, she had a Spanish test the next day, and she thought I had taken her to help tutor me for the Spanish test. Kind of odd. An odd thing to say," end quote. And to that, I say, no, Ted. Nope. It's not odd. She was an innocent young girl who, before helping you out because you were hobbing along on crutches you didn't need, she helped you out of the goodness of her heart. But before that, she was worried about her Spanish final. So after you knocked her out with a crowbar to the back of her head, I imagine she felt a pretty disoriented when she woke up. Instead of recognizing her as the child that she was, you mocked her, then knocked her out again with the crowbar, drove her to their destination, assaulted her, and strangled her to death. Because of all the girls going missing in Washington, police took this missing persons report very seriously, and within hours, they were all over the campus searching for clues. However, they missed the most crucial clue they could ever have. The next afternoon, Ted Bundy biked around the campus, and he casually rode past the alley that was roped off with crime scene tape and swarming with police, and made his way to the parking lot where he recovered Georgianne's shoe and the earrings that he had knocked from her head after the blow from his crowbar. Could you imagine? Like, they're searching everywhere, and Ted Bundy is just casually biking past you to pick up evidence. This is the first time that Ted Bundy admitted to visiting the bodies of his victims. He claims that he returned to where he dumped her body 3 days after her murder to decapitate her head and bury it in another location. Now, I told you this was going to get rough, but remember when I said that Ted Bundy had a certain morbid sexual desire? Well, it's widely believed that Ted not only visited the bodies of his victims to relive the event like so many serial killers do, but also so that he could continue to sexually assault them. Now, it takes a particularly predatory individual to take the lives of innocent young women, but to assault them, even in death, continuing to control and violate them, let's just say that Ted Bundy has certainly earned himself a special place in hell. At this point, 6 women have gone missing. Obviously, this is front page news, and they're reporting that this all seemed to be happening late in the evening, and that many scenes there's reports of a man wearing a sling or a cast or crutches who was driving a tan or brown VW bug. But Ted Bundy was certainly aware of what the papers were reporting. There's even a chance he was privy to a bit more information into the investigation than the rest of the general public. He was, after all, inserting himself right into the investigations. Remember in part one when I talked about Ted Bundy working at the Suicide Prevention Hotline Center and how absolutely maddening that was? Well, get this. Because at the same time that he is abducting, assaulting, and murdering numerous women, Ted Bundy was working as the assistant director of the Seattle Crime Prevention Advisory Commission. He even helped write a pamphlet on sexual assault prevention for women. And if that is not twisted enough, he later worked at the Department of Emergency Services, or DES, a government agency that was involved in searching for the very women that he had made disappear. Obviously, it's not uncommon for killers to get overly involved in the aftermath of their crimes. They join in search parties, go to the funerals. But Bundy took it to another level. He joined the agencies that were tasked with preventing the crimes and finding his victims. And it was while working at the DES that Ted Bundy would meet Carol Ann Boone. But we'll get back to her a bit later. Ted felt the need to shake up his routine. The newspapers are reporting that all of these abductions are happening at night. So, instead of stalking and victimizing women at night, he became even more brazen and took his next victims in complete daylight. And what's better in his mind than one victim? Two. On July 14th, at a crowded public beach, Janice Ott, 23, and Denise Naslin, 19, disappeared. Four witnesses reported that they had seen a handsome young man wearing his left arm in a sling who introduced himself as Ted. He asked all of them for help unloading his boat from his VW bug. Three of those women said, "No thank you, strange man approached me out of nowhere, asking me to accompany you to your vehicle." But the fourth agreed. However, she ran for her literal life when she got to his car and saw there was no boat. Tragically, the two girls that went missing that day, just 4 hours apart, would not be so lucky in escaping Ted Bundy. Ted had finally gotten cocky. He had gotten away with so much. And now he had taken two girls in one afternoon in broad daylight. But what he didn't account for was how much the community and the state would rally around this case. People were scared. Girls stopped hitchhiking, which might be the only good thing that Ted Bundy did for the world. Well, that and the suicide hotline, I suppose. And for the first time, police had a detailed description of the man who introduced himself as Ted and of the vehicle he was driving. Now, I've said before that eyewitness statements aren't always as accurate or concrete as we would like to think. But four women having the same account of a man trying to lure them to his vehicle, well, that's enough to bring out a forensic sketch artist to talk to them. And before you knew it, a description and sketch was not only published in the papers, but being broadcast all over the news. Guess who happened to see it and think, oh my God, is that my Ted who drives the same car and looks similar to the sketch? It can't be. It can it? Ted's girlfriend, Elizabeth.
There was something about it that just grabbed my attention. And there was just something about the jawline or something like that that made me think, wow.
And you called Seattle police?
Yeah, I called anonymously to a tip line that they had set up.
And it wasn't just Elizabeth that noticed the similarities. Ann Rule, who worked with Bundy at the suicide hotline, a DES employee and a University of Washington psychology professor, all recognized Ted Bundy from the sketch and reported him to the police. Unfortunately, the police didn't take these tips too seriously. How could a clean-cut, attractive law student with no criminal record be the guy stalking and hunting women? Well, detectives, maybe he didn't have a criminal record because he just hadn't been caught yet, and you refused to look into him. I bet the thought of people recognizing him made Ted more than a little nervous. And in a twist of fate that worked in his favor, unfortunately, he received a second acceptance letter to the law school in Utah. So in August 1974, Ted Bundy packed his things and left the state, pretending to be just another student heading off to pursue higher education. But it didn't take long for Ted to get humbled. The law students at his new school were leaps and miles ahead of him, and he quickly started falling behind. Or so Ted claimed. I think the real story is that Ted had already chosen his path. He was dedicated to controlling, abusing, and killing women. That was his true calling. And why do I think this? Because it didn't even take a month at his new school before he assaulted and strangled a hitchhiker in Idaho on September 2nd. He then returned to dismember and dispose of her remains in the river. To this day, that hitchhiker has never been identified. 4 days later, back in Washington, two hunters found the remains of Janice Ott and Denise Naslin 2 miles from the state park that they had been abducted from. They weren't alone, though. There was an extra femur bone and multiple vertebrae also found at this site. Ted later would claim that they belonged to George Ann Hawkins, although that has never been proven. We know Ted is a psychopath, but he seemed to really crank up the crazy a notch in Utah. I wish I could understand why he changed tactics in the next two cases, but I think, like Ockman's razor, the simple explanation is most likely the right one. Ted Bundy was not living with Elizabeth anymore, his girlfriend, and he didn't have to play stepdad of the year to her daughter. He was doing poorly at school, so not only did he have more free time, but more privacy. And on October 18th, Melissa Ann Smith, who was just 17 years old, and the daughter of the police chief of a suburb outside of Salt Lake City, disappeared after leaving a pizza parlor around 9:30 p.m. Her unclothed body was found 9 days later, and her autopsy indicated that she had been kept alive for up to 7 days. 7 days, this little girl was kept by Ted Bundy. Her gravestone reads, I don't believe in goodbye. And seeing that just broke me, because Melissa's parents and friends should never have had to say goodbye like this. And to think about the torture of every night for 9 days of them going to bed, wondering what was happening to their daughter, and then later finding out their worst nightmares not only were true, but probably not even as bad as what happened to this poor girl. And I'm not going to cry yet. Okay, maybe I am. It's just so sad. In some real trick-or-treat sadism type shit, on Halloween night, Laura Aim, also 17, disappeared after leaving a party by herself around midnight and was last seen trying to hitchhike. Now, before you go, oh, well, she should not be hitchhiking. This was a different time. This is the 70s, and this was a fairly safe community in Utah that had not been made aware of the abductions and murders of the girls in Washington. And in another gut-wrenching holiday blow, her unclothed body was found Thanksgiving Day. I cannot imagine her parents ever celebrated that holiday again. The medical examiner estimated that she was kept alive for 20 days before Ted ended her life. Both of these beautiful young women had not only suffered emotionally during their captivity, but they had been subjected to sexual and physical assaults of all manners. Like, if you can think it, Ted did it, until he eventually beat them and strangled them with a rope. He would also tell of how he bathed their corpses and applied makeup to their faces before disposing of them. And I can't even touch on the necrophilia thing again, but I think it's safe to imagine that that probably came into play here as well. I honestly don't think that I have true hatred towards anyone in my life. That isn't an emotion that comes naturally to me. Sure, I mean, of course, I have dislike and indifference towards some people, but I'm saying it with my full chest. I hate Ted Bundy. I hate what he inflicted on these poor women. And for what? Because his little fragile man ego couldn't get over his first love, who dumped him in college, so he took it out on any woman that resembled her? Get a life. Get a hobby. Not this hobby, obviously. But what a pathetic little... there's not enough words. But you know what this little douche canoe did not expect? Was for one of his captives to outsmart him. Enter into the chat, Carol DeRanche. On November 8th, 1974, Carol was doing what most teenagers do, or at least what they used to do before Amazon. She was hanging out at the mall. A man approached her claiming to be Officer Rosalind, and he had witnessed someone trying to break into her car. He seemed really polite, well-dressed, and trustworthy, and so she went back to her car with him to see if anything could be reported missing or if there had been any damage done to her car. We know what Ted was trying to do. He was trying to get her to lean forward into her car to peek around so he could do what he had to so many others, whack her across the back of the head and take her. But when she didn't, Ted, or Officer Rosalind, quickly came up with a new plan. He told her that they were actually holding the suspect and that she could accompany him to the police station to file a report. Bundy must have gotten pretty close to her, because what Carol noticed was alcohol in his breath. Also, I don't know if I've mentioned that yet, but Ted Bundy usually liked to indulge in a bit of liquid courage before committing these murders. I'm sure she thought, well, that's a bit weird for an officer to smell like booze, but honestly, I think we've all smelled that awful day after drinking sweat that seeps out of people, and maybe she just chalked it up to that. However, a little weirded out, she asked for identification, and without hesitation, he showed her his badge.
Just was starting to feel a little uneasy, and I thought I could smell alcohol. And that's when he just promptly pulled out his wallet and showed me a badge. And I went, oh, okay. He drove a Volkswagen, which I thought, well, that's kind of odd, but maybe he's undercover.
So into his VW Bug she went. Yep, he was still driving the same vehicle. Please keep in mind, we have the power of hindsight in knowing who Ted Bundy was. Carol, however, was just a teenager being approached by someone who appeared to be in law enforcement, someone we are told to obey. Maybe he was working at the mall undercover. Maybe that's why he wasn't driving a police car. Or maybe it's just because, as I am sure you have figured out, this was no officer at all. It was just Ted Bundy trying out a different ruse. Carol noticed that they were not going in the direction of the police station. In fact, he had driven down a side road in the total opposite direction before pulling over and attempting to handcuff her. Carol was obviously terrified, and thankfully, she fought with everything she had. She was scratching him and throwing her body around so that he could not get the second handcuff on her. He then produced a gun and told her that he would blow her head off. But Carol seemed to innately know, if you are ever abducted, you never go to a second location. Fight with everything you have to not go to a second location. And with a gun pointed at her, she jumped out of the vehicle and he came after her holding his trusty crowbar. Carol fought him with everything she had and managed to flag down an oncoming car who brought her to safety. Ted, the human antonym of BDE, could not handle that a teenage girl had outsmarted him and outmaneuvered him. He was in a blind rage and he had something to prove. Deborah Kent was just 17 and attending a high school play with her parents. Deborah was the oldest of five children and actually enjoyed the responsibility of taking care of her siblings, so she left the play a bit early to pick her brother up. Unfortunately, she never showed up. Three witnesses at the school that day told police that a man had approached them asking them to come outside with him to identify a car in the parking lot. When the police were on the scene, they found a tiny little key. And what do you know? It was the key that unlocked the handcuffs that had been placed on Carol's wrists just hours before. It was noted that this key was a smaller key than that of the handcuffs that are normally carried by police officers. And it's for a special type of handcuff that was made in Taiwan. How many people are walking around with a handcuff key at a high school that just so happens to unlock the handcuffs around another teenage victim? Poor Deborah's parents would go years without knowing what happened to their daughter. Given the evidence of the key and what had just happened to Carol, they of course had a pretty good idea. But later, Ted would not only confess to murdering her, but he kept her at his house for about 24 hours. When asked if she was alive during the entire time, he chillingly answered, about half of it.
Was she killed right there at the school?
No.
But you are responsible for her death, though, right?
Yes.
Did it take place in your car or
the place where I lived? Day. 24 hours.
Yeah. Was she alive during the time of being there?
Let's see. During half of it.
Go straight to hell, sir. Just do not pass go, do not collect $200, go straight to hell where you belong. He also told police where they could find her remains, but the police did not have any luck. In 1989, the police again searched, and while they unearthed hundreds of bones from the area, only one human bone was recovered, a kneecap. I've never heard of this happening, literally ever, but the police gave the kneecap to Deborah's parents and said, "This is the only closure we can give you." They didn't even know for sure it belonged to Deborah at this point. Like, what in the evidence chain of command breakdown is happening here? However, I'm really, really grateful this happened. Because in 2015, when they could finally run a DNA profile, the Kent family's DNA matched the kneecap that they found. I read a newspaper report and Deborah's mother described Ted Bundy as the cancer of their family. Not only had Ted Bundy taken the life of Deborah, but her brother, who Deborah had left the play to pick up that night, never forgave himself. He turned to alcohol and died at the age of 26 in a drunk driving accident. Deborah's father also turned to alcohol to numb, and their 29-year marriage came to an end. When writing this, I had to come up with a lot of adjectives to try to describe Ted Bundy, but I ran out of ways to describe him because he is so far removed from everything good in humanity. But Deborah's mom called him a cancer, and I could not sum it up more perfectly. Ted Bundy is a cancer whose reign of terror not only snuffed out the lives of his victims, but destroyed families and whole communities' sense of safety. Ted Bundy's girlfriend, still back in Washington, started hearing about the girls going missing in Utah. So she again contacted police and they interviewed her. But when one of the eyewitnesses failed to point Ted Bundy out in the lineup, they did not have any evidence to arrest him. Elizabeth didn't give up, though. She called a third time that December to report that she suspected her boyfriend was the man who abducted all the missing girls in Washington and in Utah. And I've got to commend Elizabeth. Imagine how terrifying that would be to think of the person that you shared your life with, who your daughter thought of as a father figure, was the person capable of hurting all these young women. But you don't know for sure. You don't have any evidence, and you love this person. When Ted completed final exams, probably pretty poorly since he wasn't attending much classes at this point, Elizabeth, well, she got a little ring-ding-ding on her doorbell, and she welcomed him home, never telling him that she had contacted the police 3 times with her suspicion. Oh my gosh, if that was me, actually, I can't even pretend to know what I would do in that situation, because on one hand, you are going to bed next to the man that you love, but on the other hand, you may be going to bed next to a serial killer who you never truly knew. What an absolute mind scramble that would be in the battle of head versus heart. I don't know if anyone had it harder than Elizabeth. It's now 1975. Yeah, it's been just a year since Ted Bundy's first confirmed victim. And now in January of 1975, he would take his 15th confirmed victim. With Utah a little too hot on his tail after a victim had gotten away from him, he came over to my neck of the woods here in Colorado. On January 12th, just days after he left his week-long visit with Elizabeth and her daughter, a 23-year-old nurse named Karen Campbell disappeared while staying at the inn in Snowmass Village. She had been visiting with her fiancé, who was a cardiologist, and his 2 children. By all accounts, the 2 were madly in love, and she was excited to have fun in the snow with the kids while he attended a cardiology conference. They were all just hanging out in the hotel lounge when she decided she wanted to grab a magazine from their room. So she went up just 1 level to the 2nd floor, and she ran into some doctors who she knew. She made quick, polite conversation before heading towards her room down this brightly lit hallway. She was never spotted alive again. Her unclothed body was found over 1 month later next to the road. Due to wildlife interference, they could not positively identify the method of her murder, but she had sustained heavy fractures to her skull and multiple cuts to her ear and other parts of her body. On March 2nd, 2 students studying forestry would find a human skull on Taylor Mountain. Once police arrived the next day, they would find the additional remains and the skull and mandibles of 4 victims. Using dental records, they discovered these were the remains of Linda Healy, Susan Rancourt, Roberta Parks, and Brenda Ball. Bundy would later admit that he also dumped Donna Manson's body there, but her remains were not identified. On March 15th, Julie Cunningham, a ski instructor, disappeared while leaving her apartment to join a friend for dinner. Ted would say that he approached her on his crutches, asking for help carrying his ski boots to his car. He then knocked her out, handcuffed her, and drove her to a secondary site where he assaulted and strangled her. 1 month after her murder, he drove the almost 6 hours from Salt Lake City back to where he had dumped her body to visit her. Quote, sadly, her remains have never been recovered. On April 6th, Denise Oliverson went missing near Grand Junction while riding her bike to her parents' home. Her bike and shoes were found, but she never was. Ted said he disposed of her body in the Colorado River. This confession was corroborated by credit card receipts showing Ted Bundy had been in the same city on the same day that Denise went missing. On May 6th of that year, Bundy added to his victim profile when he parked outside a junior high school. Yes, I said a junior high school. He saw 12-year-old Lynette Culver walking by herself and lured her into his vehicle. I'm not going to go into the details of this particular case, mainly because she's so young. But after she passed away, her body was never found. Bundy could provide details about Lynette's life that only someone who had come in close contact with her would know, which is what corroborated his confession. Susan Curtis was just 15 years old and attending a youth conference at Brigham Young University when she left a formal banquet to return to her room to brush her teeth. Now that sounds a little bit funny. You're in all of your formal like prom garb and you're walking back to the dorm to brush your teeth. But Susan at this time had braces. And if you've ever had braces, you know, you have to brush after every single ounce of food that you eat to get all of those little bits out. She never returned. and Ted Bundy confessed to her murder and disposing of her body. Her remains also were never recovered. Police in Washington are trying to figure out what in the heck is going on. They had a woman go missing nearly once a month, and then suddenly it stops. Then they find the remains of many of their bodies up at Taylor Mountain. And someone within the force came up with a great idea. You see, this is long before the time that we walked around with palm-sized computers in our hands and called them iPhones. In fact, this is the first time ever that a computer was used to compile and index the tips and leads into an investigation. The police take all of the list of classmates, acquaintances, VW bug owners, any man named Ted, and check them for overlaps. And out of the thousands of names and pieces of information, Ted Bundy's name came up with just 25 others on a list of people that should be looked into. Now, just as Washington police are starting to give a bit more credit towards the tip from Ted's own girlfriend, saying you should look into my man's, he's a bit suspicious, a patrol officer named Howard was pulling Ted Bundy over in Utah. See, it was real early in the morning, like before the sun had even come up. And police officer Howard noticed a car just cruising down residential areas. But when the driver of the vehicle saw a cop car, he quickly sped away, blowing through two stop signs. Not suspicious at all there, Ted. So Howard flashes his lights and pulls him over. Howard approaches the vehicle and notices that the passenger seat has been removed. It's odd. And he asks the driver of the vehicle if he could give the vehicle a quick search. And guess what this officer found? A ski mask. A mask that was cut into pantyhose. Gloves. A crowbar. Handcuffs. Trash bags. Rope. And an ice pick. Basically a whole ass kill kit just chilling in the back of Ted Bundy's car. So Howard's like, sir? Sir, I'm gonna need to understand why you're driving in the dark in the suburbs, because it sure looks like you're about to use all of this stuff here to break into someone's home. Ted Bundy pulls a, who, me? Never! And says, no, officer, the masks are for skiing. Ted, a mask made of pantyhose is not really going to protect you from the cold, but anyway. And that he had found the handcuffs while he was dumpster diving. Howard is not buying it, and he put Ted Bundy under arrest for suspicion of burglary. They get back to the station, and Howard's telling the other officers, like, you won't believe what I found in this man's car. And Detective Thompson goes, wait. You arrested a man named Ted in a VW bug that had handcuffs and a crowbar in it? And Howard's like, yeah, what's it to ya? Obviously, these are not direct quotes. I'm just imagining how this conversation went down. The detective had remembered the tip they'd gotten about a man named Ted Bundy, and they get a search warrant to search Bundy's apartment. In his apartment, they found a guide to a Colorado ski resort with a check mark by the inn that Karen disappeared from. And wouldn't you guess it? Also a brochure advertising the high school play where Deborah had been abducted from. I get that this is all very circumstantial evidence, so they had to let Ted Bundy go. They had held him originally thinking that he had been canvassing houses to burglarize, and he clearly was not doing that, so they had to let him go. And Ted was probably pretty surprised to be released after the police searched his apartment. Because what the police had failed to find was a collection of twisted, disgusting Polaroids that Ted had taken of his victims. All the evidence that police would ever need to lock this man up and throw away the key forever was in that home. And they missed it. So Ted immediately returned home, destroys the Polaroids, which, yes, people make mistakes, but it is so frustrating because you know Ted, the man who had the most inflated sense of self, was sitting in that home, destroying that crucial evidence, thinking, I just got away with it, like I always do, na-na-na-na-boo-boo, police. Police didn't have enough evidence to arrest him for anything, right? But they certainly had enough evidence to put surveillance on him. And Detective Thompson hopped on the next flight to talk to Ted's loving girlfriend, Elizabeth, in person. Someone is finally taking this woman seriously, and Elizabeth had a lot to say because she had been conducting a little investigation of her own behind Ted's back. She had done her own search of her Washington home and found crutches. That's odd because no one in that house had been injured. She found a bag of plaster of Paris. It's what it's used to make casts, amongst other things. But Elizabeth and her daughter weren't doing any papier-mâché projects. There's no reason to have that in their home. And why was there a meat cleaver somewhere in her home other than the kitchen? What really shocked her was when she opened a bag of women's clothes that did not belong to her or her daughter. Ted didn't have a high-paying job. He is a student, not a very good one at that. And so she was surprised when at one point he had come home with a state-of-the-art TV and stereo equipment. And she's like, funny, Ted, you can't help me buy groceries, but you can buy this. Well, at least that's what I would say. And Ted responded, if you tell anyone, I'll break your effing neck. Okay, now we're getting into it, Elizabeth. Behind the scenes, your relationship was not so hunky-dory. In fact, she told police that she also found it odd that when she told Ted that she wanted to cut her hair to try out a new style, he became enraged. And I want you all to guess why. Well, Ted Bundy preferred her long, dark hair to be down and parted in the middle. Which, cool, everyone has their preferences. But all the girls that had been murdered had the very same hairstyle. I also do not know what the heck was up with this. But she told police that she would sometimes be woken up in the middle of the night by Ted fully under their comforter, just searching her body with a flashlight, examining her. I never want to yuck anybody's yum. Consensual kinks, go for it. But what in the world could you imagine waking up to that multiple times? Like, what exactly are you looking for there, Ted? Like, are we doing a skin cancer check? It's weird. She also confirmed he had not been home any of the nights that the girls had gone missing or during the day that the two women vanished from the park. I came across a little piece of information while doing the research on this case that I just had to include because I love a girl's girl, women looking out for women. When Kathy McChesney, a homicide detective, conducted a follow-up interview, she dropped a sneaky little bombshell. I, of course, was not in the room, but I like to think it went down a little something like this. Thank you so much for taking the time today, Elizabeth. This is really great information, and you are so brave to share it with me. I'm sure you're scared, confused, and you love Ted, right? You don't want to believe he would lie to you. You want to believe that this is all some sort of coincidence, right? I understand that, but we talked to Ted's ex-fiance and saw a little overlap with y'all's dating timeline. Now, I'm not trying to stir up any drama here, Elizabeth, but do you know a woman named Diane? And did you know that he was dating her too, that he even proposed to her last Christmas? No? Well, honey, if he's willing to lie to you about that, what else could he be lying about? Here's my card, babe. You call me if you think of anything else that might be helpful. Then she chassés out of the living room, leaving Elizabeth speechless. End scene. Okay, it probably didn't go like that, but I think this was so smart because we know that leaving a partner is not always black and white. But dropping that little bombshell on Elizabeth was probably meant to sway her judgment of Ted Bundy even further. It's genius, really. Ted knew that his VW bug needed to go. Too many people had reported a tan VW bug in connection with these crimes. But he was on surveillance. So when he sold it to a teenager, poor unsuspecting teenager, Utah police pull up right behind and immediately impound the vehicle. Like, poor kid, he has a car for, what, 15 minutes? And they found hairs that matched those from the victim's bodies. This was before DNA analysis, but a lab tech said, listen, guys, these are microscopically indistinguishable from each other. The presence of hair strands in one car matching three different victims who had never met each other in life would be a coincidence of, quote, mind-boggling rarity, end quote. Ted Bundy was put in a lineup, and Carol, the girl that escaped him, immediately identified him, even though Ted Bundy had gone to great lengths to disguise himself by parting his hair in the opposite direction. And Ted was finally arrested for something. Not for murder, but for the aggravated kidnapping and attempted criminal assault on Carol's case. His mom bailed him out, and he went back to Washington to live with Elizabeth. Elizabeth, my girl. What are we doing? However, Utah police and Washington police know that this is our guy. Ted Bundy is the man who's killed all these young women, but they don't have enough evidence just yet. There was so much surveillance on Ted that Elizabeth later said, when Ted and I stepped out on the porch to go somewhere, so many unmarked police cars started up that it sounded like the beginning of the Indy 500. The police from the different states where the women had gone missing, well, they started talking to each other. And they had a meeting of the minds in Aspen, Colorado in November, just in time for ski season. Jerry Thompson from Utah, Robert Keppel from Washington, and Michael Fisher from Colorado. When they all compared notes, they knew Ted Bundy was their man. They just had to get more evidence. At this time, Elizabeth had finally seen enough, and she broke up with Ted. She said, quote, "I hate to even say this because it makes him sound normal, but I do think he loved us. I heard a story told by one of his attorneys he had. He said that Ted told him that he would play games with these animals. I don't remember if they were mice or something else." And then her daughter, Molly, interjected and said, "And he would let some of them live and some of them die. And to me, that's us. We're just these mice that were allowed to live." When Ted finally stood trial for what he did to Carol in February of 1976, he waived his right to a jury. There was so much press around the missing women that he didn't think that they could get an impartial jury. He was probably right about that. However, the judge still found him guilty and sentenced Ted to 1 to 15 years with the possibility of parole, which is quite the range, 1 to 15 years. Also, I'm going to go off on a little tangent here, but I get so mad about this because I really don't understand getting a lighter sentence for attempted crimes. If you are not successful in what was clearly your intent to kill someone, why are you rewarded with a lesser sentence for not being good at what you were trying to do? Not just in this case, but in general, I have never understood that. You beat someone, you abduct them, you threaten them with weapons, and it's like our system goes, well, you didn't actually kill the person. Like, it's pretty obvious you planned to. So we're just going to do a lighter sentence so that you're back on the streets sooner and have the opportunity to give it another go. It makes zero sense to me. And let me know your thoughts, though. Should attempted crimes, kidnapping, assault, murder be held to the same sentencing guidelines as those that came to fruition? I think so. Later that month, police in Colorado charged Ted Bundy with the murder of Karen Campbell after matching the indentations in her skull to the crowbar that was found in his vehicle. Since murder is more of a serious charge than kidnapping, he was transferred to a Colorado prison to stand trial for her murder. Ted made a rather interesting choice. He decided his legal team was inept, and because no one thinks higher of Ted Bundy than Ted Bundy, he decided, despite never finishing law school, that he should represent himself. He was telling anyone who would listen that he was innocent and that he was going to prove it. If you listen to my coverage of the Isaac Wright Jr. case during Black History Month last year, you might remember how risky of a move it is to represent yourself. If you don't know the ins and outs of court proceedings, you could seriously piss off a judge, unless they have the patience of a saint. You can't just be shouting, "Objection!" to everything that the prosecution says. You've got to know the rules and be able to abide by them. But Ted had ulterior motives for representing himself. This move came with certain privileges. In court, it meant he didn't have to wear shackles or cuffs, which could sway the jury's opinion of his innocence or guilt. That makes sense to me. Plus, he got to be escorted from the jail to the courthouse library in Aspen. And that makes sense too, right? You have to be able to research, show precedent of similar cases, and so on. But Ted wasn't researching his cases. He was planning his escape. On June 7th, 1977, Ted was escorted to the courthouse for a preliminary hearing. During the recess, he asked the judge if he could be taken to the library to research his case. The judge agreed. After all, Ted would be escorted by a guard the entire time. What could possibly go wrong? Once inside the library, Ted slipped behind a bookshelf out of the guard's line of sight and opened a window. Now, if you're wondering why the windows weren't bolted shut, remember, this is the second floor of the courthouse. They didn't think anyone would be using the window for anything more than a fresh breeze. With the window now open and the guard not looking, Ted escaped. He jumped from the second story of the Pitkin County Courthouse. Shockingly, he only hurt his ankle in the fall. And without shackles, no one would notice the man who had shed his outer layer of clothing and was casually walking down the streets of small town Aspen. Ted hiked up to Aspen Mountain, found a hunting cabin, broke in, stole food, new clothes, and a rifle. The next day, he set off again but got completely lost, wandering the mountainside for 2 days without any course of direction. Meanwhile, the police were everywhere, setting up roadblocks and organizing search parties, but they had no luck. Ted was walking in circles, completely lost in the mountains until he finally figured out how to get down. Quick tip, if you are ever lost in the woods, climb a tree to see which direction you need to go. You see, Ted's smart, but only it seemed when it came to being a criminal. Otherwise, he lacked good common sense, it seems. Ted makes it down to the Aspen Golf Course. He steals a vehicle, and instead of driving out of town, again, not very smart, he drove back into Aspen. Ted was weak and exhausted at this point. He had been sleeping, except for the night in the cabin, in negative degree temperatures. And he is swerving all over the road, and the police pull him over. After 6 days of freedom, Ted Bundy was back in custody.
News killer Theodore Bundy was captured early this morning, 2 miles from Aspen, Colorado. He was on the main road driving a car he admitted taking just a short time earlier. Barbara Grossman was in Aspen this morning and has this report.
At 2 this morning, after being loose for 6 days, Bundy was captured by Pitkin County officers Maureen Higgins and Gene Flatt. But they weren't looking for Bundy. They were on a routine investigation.
I noted a vehicle driving erratically about an eighth of a mile east of Aspen on Highway 82. We observed this vehicle for a matter of seconds, and I turned around and pursued it, contacted it, and found Mr. Bundy driving it.
Did you recognize him right away?
It took about two glances. He was pretty altered. His appearance had been altered by glasses and a minor growth of beard.
Actually, he was pretty dopey. I think he was pretty tired. He was cooperative in that he pretended to search for his license when we asked for it, and he wasn't aggressive toward us in any way.
Did he say where he was heading?
He did not.
He just stated he was going to leave the valley if possible.
Hi, Ted. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Here.
He had lost about 15 pounds. His body was scratched. He injured his knee while mountain climbing. He was exhausted, disoriented. Judge George Lohr advised him of additional charges: escape, second-degree burglary, misdemeanor theft, and a felony theft. If convicted of these charges alone, Bundy could spend 90 years in prison.
Now here's the thing. The prosecution's case in the murder of Karen was all circumstantial. They couldn't genetically prove the hairs from his car and Karen's matched. How do you know someone else didn't have that exact crowbar? Their case was thin. Honestly, if he had stuck it out, there was probably a good chance he would have been acquitted or found not guilty. But you know what else was thin? Ted Bundy. 6 days on the run had shrunk his waistline, and he kept losing weight, getting down to about 140 pounds, which is very thin for a 6-foot-tall man. His weight loss had a purpose. Somehow, Ted had gotten a hold of a detailed floor plan of the jail and a hacksaw blade from other prisoners. He accumulated $500 in cash, which was smuggled in over the 6 months by visitors, including one in particular who we will discuss later. One evening, he managed to saw a hole around his light fixture about 1 square foot in diameter between the steel-reinforced bars in his cell's ceiling. Like some James Bond movie, Ted Bundy was slipping into his little hideaway at night, exploring the jail's crawl space. Multiple inmates even reported hearing him crawling in the ceiling at night. But of course, no one paid much attention and it was never investigated. On December 30th, with the jail staff down to a skeleton crew for the holidays, Ted laid out all of his books and files on his bed and covered them with a blanket to make it look like he was sleeping. Then he maneuvered himself up to his little hidey hole in the ceiling and made his way into a jailer's apartment. He walks over to the closet, changes into this man's clothes, and walks out of the apartment front door a free man once again. He had escaped prison twice at this point. The jail staff didn't even realize something was wrong until around noon the next day when the cook at the prison thought it was a little weird that Ted Bundy hadn't showed up for breakfast or lunch. Ted Bundy, a serial killer, had a 17-hour head start on police. And that is where I'm going to leave you for part two. Thank you so much for your patience while I let my mouth heal. We're going to pick up next Sunday for the conclusion of this case. But just so you know, While we discussed a lot of his victims today, there are going to be even more to come before we wrap this up. Thank you so much for joining me today. If you liked this episode, please take a moment to rate and review this podcast. It truly does help. And then if you're watching on YouTube, hit the subscribe and thumbs up button. I will see you all next Sunday, but as always, until then.